The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, comrades, the meeting has a rather long and cumbersome title, but I'm actually going to be talking about neoliberalism and whether we still live in a neoliberal era, whether we moved on to something else, or whether it's not quite clear yet. I remember, just as a way of beginning, about 10, 15 years ago, say, when the term neoliberalism began to be used, and I think the main turning point here would be David Harvey's book, A Brief History of Neoliberalism, came out in 2005. Before then, it had been a kind of more esoteric kind of term that Marxist political economists might use, but it wasn't in public use. After Harvey's book, I think it became normal discourse to talk about neoliberalism as the kind of era we're passing through. At the time, I found that there was a lot of resistance from people on the radical and revolutionary left to the idea. And a lot of people were very sceptical that there was such a thing as neoliberalism. And that opposition came from, I think, two different sources. One, I think, and this particularly would apply, I suppose, to comrades in the political Marxist tradition, were those who emphasise the underlying fundamental aspects of capitalism which don't change. The exploitation of labour by capital, obviously, what they call market, the compulsion of markets to drive both workers and capitalists. And these things don't change over time, they're permanent aspects of the capitalist system. Now, that's obviously true, but I think there's always a danger in looking at these fundamental things of being trapped in a kind of abstract model of what capitalism should look like, based often on a reading of Capital Volume 1, which is not meant to be an economic history of England or anything, it's meant to be an abstract model of the system. You can't then apply that to the world and go, oh, this isn't matching what Marx wrote in Capital. I mean, it's an attempt at an ideal type, if you want to use a Weberian kind of language here. So clearly, in the actual historical unfolding of capitalism, a lot of things happen which are quite different from the way that Marx describes them in Capital. I mean, imperialism, for example, as an aspect of capitalist development, isn't really touched on by Marx and couldn't have been, because it didn't exist. So the new things do happen in the history of capitalism, which that's just one. The second, I mean, but yeah, the general underlying point is correct. There are obviously some things that are permanent about the capitalist system. The second thing was a kind of rejection by Marxists of a fixation with the new. Everything's new. I mean, Tony Blair turned up shortly after he became Prime Minister in Britain to a meeting of the Socialist International, which does still exist, believe it or not. And he said, new, everything is new. And of course, the Communist Party in Britain, with Marxism Today, a journal, I think, called New Times. And these were all things saying that the working class had fundamentally been transformed, the world had been totally changed, therefore all your silly old ideas about revolutionary politics and so on have to be ditched, we have to look for alliances with the middle classes, we have to blah, 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 and so on. So understandably, people responded to that by going, well, if you keep telling me how new everything is, and we have to ditch our politics on the basis of this newness, then let's forget it. There obviously is no new thing happening here. It's simply good old capitalism as we've always known it, and we have to fight it in the same kind of way. Unfortunately, what this led to was a kind of denial of reality. You know, I can't remember how often I heard people telling me that jobs weren't really going to the global south. That was just a kind of, I think, to keep workers whipped in line. That looks pretty silly now, looking at the way China has developed and so on. So, there's not to say they all have, obviously they're not, but I mean, you've got to, I think, keep up with what's actually happening and not simply take this attitude of, we want the world to be like it was in 1973 because we knew what to do then and we don't know now. We have to kind of move beyond that, I think. So that was one thing, it's a kind of denial of neoliberalism. Now I think the problem is the opposite one. Now it's neoliberalism's here to stay forever, it's never going to change, it'll be neoliberalism till we overthrow the system. I think that's an equally wrong kind of position. I think clearly we are seeing things changing now. Now whether that means we're in a new phase of capitalist development, I'm going to try and touch on in the discussion, but I think that the point is saying it's the equal and opposite error, where you simply say, all right, that's neoliberalism is going to be here till the end. I don't think that's true either. So, are we in a new phase of neoliberalism or a new phase of capitalism altogether? Let's start by talking about what neoliberalism was, and perhaps still is. I think there are four ways one can sensibly talk about neoliberalism. The first is that it's a theory, or perhaps better say an ideology, created in Central Europe, really between the First and Second World Wars, with people like Otto Spahn, Friedrich von Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, several other people with the word von in their names. And the basic idea was a kind of extreme version of neoclassical economics, in which the notion was that markets are what define capitalism. And if you don't have functioning markets, I suppose, as a kind of advice of a kind of knowledge generating thing of what people want and what they'll buy, then you don't have capitalism. That leads to the end of freedom. Freedom is defined here almost in an entirely economic way, particularly by von Hayek, of course, in his classic, I suppose you could call it, the Road to Serfdom in 1944. Now, one thing that's clear about the neoliberalism as an ideology, or theology perhaps, is that it does believe in the role for the state. It's not like the pure neoclassical, which just shunts the state off to one side. The neoliberals, and some of them did call themselves that, by the way, in the 30s and 40s, they do see a role for the state of creating the conditions for the kind of market order that they see as necessary for the survival of capitalism. The minute you move away from this, the minute the state begins to play a role in actually determining the economy itself, then you've not got capitalism. This is their argument. This is why Hitler's Germany, Stalin's Russia, Attlee's Britain, for God's sake, after 1945. These are all examples of something where capitalism had been ditched because the market wasn't functioning entirely as the dominant force. Now, this is obviously nonsense, but it is kind of aligned with certain theories of managerial society, bureaucratic collectivism, and so on, as an alternative to markets. So it's an ideology. That's the first thing. Interestingly, and I will say this in debates about the European Union, von Hayek did actually say at one point in 1943, wouldn't it be great if you could find a way of stopping idiot voters voting for politicians who do things that are against the market? If only we'd a kind of international bureaucracy that people weren't elected to, that you could actually have a set of rules that were then imposed on all the member states, wouldn't that be fantastic? And yes, we've got that. It's called the European Union. That's exactly what it does. So anything tells you how marvellous the EU is, let's think, you know, this is a Hayekian kind of model of how to control democracy and prevent it getting in the way. Okay, just aside. The second thing is neoliberalism is a strategy. It's a strategy for getting out of the economic crisis that began in 1973. I mean, there had been rumblings of economic problems from about 1966, but that crisis broke in 73. So it's a means of actually tackling that, a ruling class strategy for resolving the crisis at the expense, of course, of the working class. Out of that, and this is the third aspect of neoliberalism, it's what I suppose you'd call a regime. Now, on the one hand, we have governments which come and go, get elected, get kicked out, and so on. These are temporary things. And we have the state, which is the permanent apparatus that runs capital and necessarily runs capital in individual state forms. But between governments and the state, you have what I call regimes, which are not just governments, but are continuations. So you think of the social democratic Keynesian kind of regime, the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, the Labour Party. They're all different parties, and they all have slightly different takes on it, but they're all basically maintaining the same kind of overall approach to managing the economy. What I'm suggesting is that the strategy of neoliberalism led to, from the election of Thatcher in 79 in Britain and Reagan in 81 here, the establishment of regimes, which even though the parties changed, interchanged with elections, they're actually more or less the same kind of fundamental economic policy was maintained by the different parties. So that's what I call a regime, and so we talk about the neoliberal regime in general, this is what we're talking about. Fourth and finally, and this brings us, I suppose, to the central point, neoliberalism is a period, it's an era or an epoch in the history of capitalism. It's a distinct period in its own right. Now, there have been, I think, about four major eras in capitalist history. If we think about the system becoming, its laws of motion being generally established in an international way by about 1848, 1850, certainly the middle of the 19th century, and this is the form of capitalism, the classic liberal free market type system. It was never completely free even at this point, but nevertheless, we can generally characterise it that way. New periods in capitalist history come with crises. So if you look at 1873, the first Great Depression, and out of that you begin to get capitalism emerging in a different form. The emergence of imperialism, finance capital, monopoly capitalism, the various terms that are used, but it's clearly something new and different, and expansion of capital into the global south, and not just in terms of colonies, but in terms of investment and so on. 1929 opens up another period, this more intensely one of state capitalism in general across the world, but also of Keynesianism and embedded social democracy in the West. And I do want to insist it is 1929 that's the turning point, not 1945. Actually, this is when it starts, is the late 1920s, and a lot of the things we associate with the post-war world actually started in the 1930s, for example, the term the services, expenditure on arms, you know, the characteristic things of post-45, actually start in the 30s, are interrupted by the war, obviously, but then continue again. So if you think about eras as I'm defining them here, they begin in crises, not just a normal boom slump variations, but actual full-blown crises that come every 40 years or so. And the dates have tried outlined 1873, 1929, 1973, and then perhaps 2007, 2008. That's been the question. So those periods, the eras involve slumps as well as booms. So 1929 to 1940 is a period of slump, the war, and then post-war is a period of boom. They involve continuities as well as changes. So as obviously imperialism is an aspect which continues after the 1870s right to the present day in different forms. So it's not just everything is completely new, as Tony Blair would have it. There are continuities with earlier periods. So neoliberalism, looking at it in this way, what does it mean? Well, let's start with the first phase of neoliberalism. There's a kind of interim transition period from about 1974 to about 1979 in Britain, in which the Labour Party begin to introduce some of the things we recognise as neoliberalism, but not in a full-blooded kind of way. That starts with Thatcher in 1979. And here, what I call, as an example of what I call vanguard neoliberalism, and the Leninist implications of this are right in reverse, and in a sense, a determined attempt by a potential ruling group, as Gramsci would say, to reverse what had been policy up to that point and introduce a regime of reorientation. This is Gramsci's phrase from the prison notebooks, but I think it's very applicable here. He's thinking about Mussolini, but it's also applicable here. We are trying to change an entire way of a previous way of governing, introduce a new way of doing it. And it did it in three particular ways. The key thing here being not privatisation necessarily started with a deregulation, these things came later, but actually to attack and hobble the working class and the trade union movement. That is the absolutely fundamental starting point of neoliberalism. I should say that in terms of how this relates to the theory bit or the ideology bit, it is not the case that Margaret Thatcher or, God help us, Ronald Reagan sat down with The Road to Serfdom or Ludwig von Mises' books from the 1920s and said, this is the master plan of what we're going to do. I don't think any of them read these books at all. There's a famous story about Thatcher bringing The Road to Serfdom out of her handbag and throwing it down on the cabinet table to annoy her civil servants, going, this is what we believe. I don't think Thatcher read a bloody word of Hayek in her entire life, or very much else, apart from the thrillers she used to read. It is not true that this was a kind of blueprint which people got and then applied. I do this so you don't have to, but I have actually read most of the autobiographies of the politicians who ran the Tory governments from 79 through to 92. I suffer, you know, for my art. But what they all say is, Hayek? We never heard of these people. We only started reading them after we were in power, and we began to see that some of the things we were doing were compatible with some of the stuff they'd argued for. So, and this is, I think, generally the case. It's not, it wasn't, this a rejection of what I call the ideas-led notion of neoliberalism, that it was just Hayek wrote these books and then people picked them up and did it. No, they were responding to an actual crisis. And of course, there's only so many ways you can run a capitalist economy, so if you're not going to do it in a statified, state capitalist kind of way, then you're going to run it in a way that's much more towards a partial return towards markets, which is what they were doing. So the vanguard regime, and this is also true in the States as well, I think it was based on three things. First, it was deliberately allowing unemployment to rise to the extent that it was completely incomprehensible in the previous 30 or 40 years. By high interest rates, for example, to force businesses to lay people off. And this was deliberately intended to weaken trade unions by just making it, not that people necessarily thought that they would lose their job, but the implications of what would happen to them if they did lose their job, not being able to make mortgage payments, to feed their kids, the horrors of the system, to get any kind of benefits and so on. I mean, it's much worse now, but it was bad even then. So and so this is the idea of unemployment as a weapon. And they later came out and admitted this, by the way, in various interviews with some of the leading figures at the time, and said, yeah, of course, we consciously did that to kind of, of course, we couldn't have said that at the time, but we were consciously doing this to raise unemployment levels. The second thing was to take on quite significant, well-established, powerful groups of workers and defeat them as a lesson to the rest of the trade union movement. Obviously the miners, the aircraft controllers in the States, postal workers in Canada and so on. There were conscious attempts at a face down, not to destroy the trade union movement, but to frighten the bureaucracies to the extent that they would no longer be prepared to take the kind of action that had been taken in the 70s and the 60s. And the third aspect this done more by business and employers themselves than by the state, was to move productive capacity from areas which had been unionised to greenfield sites where there weren't unions and establish some totally new territories. So in the sort of Sun Belt, I suppose, in the States, but in Scotland, the whole area between sort of north of Glasgow running to the south, the Silicon Valley or Silicon Glen, as sometimes called. And these wouldn't be productive areas, but Amazon stores. I mean, if you go on the road from Edinburgh to Glasgow, these gigantic Amazon depots, which employ hundreds of people, but they're only now potentially becoming unionised, you know, decades after they were first established. And what happened particularly, and this is happening certainly in Glasgow and London, I think it probably happened here as well, that once you'd established places without unions, you then move the businesses back into places where there had been unions previously. So there are now far more people working in call centres in Glasgow than ever worked in engineering, you know, I mean, which that city is famous for. And this happened after the unions had been smashed. So there. So those are the three things. It allowed them to do certain things. It made certain changes possible, having introduced this. One, when the economic boom returned from about 1982, workers were decreasingly able to benefit from it by forcing higher wages because they'd been weakened in the period of slump. Secondly, because wages were being lowered, it led to a massive increase in consumer debt, which really only paid off, and we saw the implications of that in 2007 and 2008. And thirdly, it drove social democracy and liberal democracy to the right in order to catch up with what they assumed was a public mood. They kept re-electing these governments, and that, of course, led to the birth of New Labour in Britain. Okay. One final thing to say about vanguard neoliberalism is it was very much tied up with traditional conservative ideology about the family, about racism, about nationalism, and so on. And that led a lot of people, including particularly Stuart Hall in Britain, to think that was the form it would always take. That it had to be this raging right-wing conservatism on one hand, as well as the free market stuff on the other. That isn't true, and the second wave of neoliberalism, what I and a lot of people call social neoliberalism, starting certainly in the States and the election of Clinton in Britain from the election of Blair, actually a bit before that. And you begin to get a kind of tendency which doesn't actually have these terrible, obviously conservative positions. In fact, it's quite open about, we're happy with gay people, we're happy with, you know, with black people, we don't, you know, as long as, you know, they get with the economic program. In other words, as long as they accept the actual economic nature of neoliberalism, then at least for the middle classes, there's going to be some sort of sense of, we accept that there's all these non-economic differences and they're bad, you know, but the actual inequalities produced by the economy, that's just inevitable and necessary and will have to stay. Now, this was the attempt to resolve a real problem, which was one that Hayek identified quite early on, is how can you stop those pesky voters voting out the parties that are carrying out the neoliberal policies? Well, one way, of course, is to establish military dictatorships, as indeed happened in Chile, and that was one of the first places where the neoliberalism was imposed outside of Britain in the UK. And in fact, Hayek wrote this infamous letter, it's infamous to me, anyway, in the Times, saying, I don't see what the problem is, this is 1975, after about 100,000 people had been shot and so on. I don't see what the problem is in Chile, I think there's re-establishing order and they're allowing freedom and markets to thrive and so on. It's like, even the most die-hard members of the ruling class find a certain amount of inconvenience in military dictatorships or fascist dictatorships. Right? So that's not their first port of call. The real issue for the solution to them was to have the parties aligned behind neoliberalism so that if one was kicked out and another one came in, they would have fundamental continuity between the parties, whatever their nominal political status, whether it was the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, whatever. And in the meantime, you would kind of shift towards a social basis of this new phase of neoliberalism by appealing particularly to sections of the new middle class, the growing sections of the managerial technical strata, as they're sometimes called, in particular two ways. One, what made it acceptable to them, one was what you might call the shift from political to cultural critique of capitalism. And there's always been a kind of conjunction of this, you know, on the one hand the ugliness and horribleness of capitalism and then the question that oppresses people. I mean, someone like William Morris, for example, embodied both critiques, but mostly capitalism is quite successful at separating them. So you get a kind of bohemian countercultural opposition to capital on the one hand, and then the kind of political trade union socialist opposition to it on the other. And they kind of intersect and move around each other, as they certainly did in 1968. But they are slightly different. There's quite a lot of writing about this now, from the French authors in particular, Patansky and so on, basically saying that a lot of 68 kind of countercultural stuff was absorbed into the system, and I think it was absorbed by neoliberalism. Hey, freedom, autonomy, your workplace, you're rolling around on skateboards and drinking artisanal coffee, whatever it is. But this idea that we're opposed to the ugliness of capitalism rather than its evil and exploitation and oppression. So that was made possible. And the second thing was identity politics. And I think we have to strongly dissociate identity from oppression, right? It's perfectly possible for neoliberals to, people have identities, as long as that affects the middle class, and as long as the proportions don't actually benefit everybody else. So working class people still get shot in the street, and all the rest of it if you're black, but, there's a middle class, and their identity is fine and preserved. I should point out, by the way, that it's not only, identity isn't always a good thing, like white racists have identities as well, and fascists and so on, it's not universal good, just talk about having an identity. It depends what it is and what political implications of that are. So these things, I think, between them made the possibility of neoliberalism acceptable to people who found Thatcher disgusting, for example, or Reagan an idiot. Thatcher was a much better politician than Reagan. I mean, Reagan was a glove puppet, basically, but Thatcher was a genuine ruling class warrior who had ideas of her own. If you read the cabinet minutes, which are now available for during the miners' strike, for example, you can see she did have a strategic conception of what she was doing. I don't think Reagan can really be accused of having that. But anyway, so there's the quality of leadership varies. So the social neoliberal phase, a lot of that has just continued. I mean, Obama is a classic social neoliberal politician. It's all about respecting everyone, their identities and so on, but the economic policies are still being continued, as indeed are the imperial policies of the state. So vanguard and social neoliberalism emerged sequentially, but then once they've arrived, you can have governments shifting between them, emphasising one or the other. So George Bush in this country obviously is more aligned with the vanguard, and George Bush II is more aligned with the vanguardist kind of positions than social neoliberalism, obviously. But what it meant politically was that the idea of left-right divide became almost entirely about culture and about social issues rather than about fundamental economic ones. The idea that Hillary Clinton represents the left in some sense is obviously ludicrous from our point of view, but in terms of just average conventional media discourse, Trump's the right because he's got these bad ideas about racism and migration and so on. Clinton's lovely because she's got these ideas. And the whole actual question of capitalism gets completely submerged, and that ideologically represents a major triumph for neoliberalism to have made that kind of thing, where politics is reduced to culture and social issues rather than more fundamental ones. Okay, so the question then is, something new happened in 2007-2008. I've tended to call this up till now crisis neoliberalism, and the kind of regime, if the vanguardists introduced reorientation and the social neoliberals had kind of consolidation, then this is a kind of crisis, or somebody would have called a regime of permanent exception. The German political theorist and later Nazi Karl Schmitt famously said, "Sovereign is he who decides the exception." In other words, who decides when you can suspend the law, when you can declare the normal processes to be shut down and lock people up and arrest them and shoot them and all the rest of it. And indeed, that's what happened. The austerity, the question of austerity, brought with it a kind of preemptive repression and diversionary scapegoating, which happened long before Trump. I mean, it's really important to remember this now, that most of the regimes, the neoliberal regimes in Western Europe and North America and so on, were all doing this at the point at which austerity kicked in. Now, it wasn't something that just happened to the populist leaders that came along a couple of years later on. This was part of the response. The real problem being, I think, that neoliberalism is no longer delivering the goods for capital, for a number of reasons. It had kind of undermined itself. If you think just briefly to... Can you pass me a water? Just to think about the state for a bit. I mentioned earlier we have government, regime, state. States are designed to kind of compensate for the idiocies of the ruling class themselves and to sort of correct their mistakes. Adam Smith famously says in several places in the Wealth of Nations, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but for God's sake, don't let businessmen become the government. These people only care about themselves. They're not even capable of thinking about their own collective interests. They'll only care about their own. They'll be a disaster. Keep them out. The worst possible government is a government of merchants, and so on and so on. I wish people would keep invoking Smith, but actually read him sometimes, because he's much more interesting writer than you would think. But he's basically, and Marx is the same thing. In Capital One, he's got this great bit, which is talking about the factory acts, and he's going, the British Parliament isn't the most intelligent bunch of people we've ever got together, but they are more intelligent than the factory owners, who are actually going to carry on working people 15 and so on and so on. So he makes a point, I think it's in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, where he says, you need to have this body above the actual capitalist class governing. And he says something that's kind of exceptional, you know, Bonapartism and so on, but actually that should be the normal process. The state cannot be run by the individual capitalists. Now, what happened under neoliberalism as it proceeded was you began to get a far greater influence, not of the capitalist class as a whole, that's impossible, but of the people who could shout loudest, who had the most money, and that particularly meant financial capital at this point, emerging as it did during this period as a major player. And that began to affect the actual way in which the states, particularly in the advanced imperialist West, were actually run. The short-termism that's associated with financial capital, kind of quick returns, you know, for Wall Street and so on, like 3 months, 9 months, instead of thinking years or decades, it's like, well, 6 months' time. And this gets built in not just to the economic policy, but actually to political policy as well. What can we do immediately that's going to satisfy our core vote? So you begin to kind of corruption of the way in which the system is run. Zizek, who I don't usually agree with, did say something sensible once, and this was that China is actually better. One of the reasons why China is thriving is because it's run by people who are nominally communists, who aren't business people in any sense. They're actually much better at telling these fuckers what to do and ordering them about than the people in the West who are enthralled to them. You know, but the Chinese government isn't like that at all. And I mean, I think there's something in that, actually, and it's one of the reasons why China is one of the most successful capitalist countries in the world. I think there are four fundamental reasons why you begin to get this problem for capital creating for itself. One of the things the first things that happened, both under Thatcher and under New Labour, was the removal or imposition of certain structural limitations on what governments could do. So, first thing Thatcher does, abolish exchange controls, 1979. First thing Gordon Brown does, take away the ability of governments to set interest rates. So they're set instead by the Bank of England. So you can get, these things could be undone, but that would be, it's difficult. So what you've got is like a situation where the kind of instruments, economic instruments are taken away and are no longer available to government. You might call that the depoliticisation of the economic. On the other hand, you have the politicisation of the state managers, the actual civil servants and so on who run the state apparatus, increasingly drawn, certainly in Britain, it's always been the case in the States to a far greater extent, but increasingly in Britain, drawn from the ranks of people who come from the capitalist class themselves or run the corporations. They become civil servants, bringing with them all of the, I mean, not that I'm trying to, unnecessarily praise my former profession. I was a civil servant for many years, but there was a certain amount of, I'm sorry, Minister, that you can't do that, or that would be a very courageous decision, Minister, sort of things that you would say to people to try and put them off doing stupid things. But then what increasingly happened is you've got people, that's great, and this is what we want to do, and here's the plan to do it, without any attempt at a kind of whose overall interest of the system is this going to be in. So there's the politicisation of the state managers, then there's the depoliticisation of the electorate, the idea that because the parties essentially all do the same thing anyway, what's the point in voting? And again, this is a classic Hayekian strategy to make it so similar that there's no point in, so massive abstention rates, which have always been big in the States, but were increasingly the case in Britain as well, until quite recently, and then exceptionally, the Scottish independence referendum is a major exception in terms of participation, but this is the other thing. And finally, and this is obviously relevant to our current dilemmas, the revival of irrationality, of kind of politics which are not based on any kind of economic calculation at all, but are simply an attempt to win political support on the basis of telling people what they want to hear or think they want to hear in relation to national racism and these kind of issues. Now again, It's important, as I said, this didn't start with Trump. It didn't start with Nigel Farage in Britain, but they have certainly run with it. And it's not just them, and it's across the world. I mean, Modi in India, in Turkey, in Poland, in Hungary, the kind of right-wing. I don't like the word populism, because I think it's a kind of covers too many different things, but certainly that kind of hard, not fascist, but hard right set of positions. To people whose communities have been destroyed by neoliberalism and have nothing. And so what's been destroyed socially for them is recreated at the level of state rhetoric about outsiders and about we belong to this great nation and all this kind of stuff, which is by which all of these people use to try and get themselves elected. Not necessarily knowing exactly what they're going to do when they do get elected, but to try and maintain this. Now, I'm not suggesting, by the way, that the politics of neoliberalism is rational. It wasn't. And the fantasies, I mean, the gibberish that's taught in economics departments for over 20 years now is truly astonishing. There's no connection with the world at all. It's simply worse than a set of assumptions which are all wrong. So it's not rational, but this is irrationality of a different kind, and one which is, okay, be less than that, actually. This is the kind of thing which is now making people say, are we now then in a different period? Are we heading into an era where neoliberalism is no longer an era of trade wars, of blocking other nations from selling goods to you, and so on? Is that the same thing as neoliberalism? Now, we have to be a bit realistic here. Neoliberalism was never about markets being totally dominant. Even in the 1980s, the steel industry here was protected for several years against foreign competition, at the same time as military Keynesianism was kind of keeping the economy. I mean, so there's always been a kind of overblown thing about markets, and that was never the real intention. And that's why I stressed the ideological nature of neoliberalism in the first definition that I gave. I mean, it obviously has moved in that direction towards certain kinds of deregulation and so on. The state still plays an important role, but it plays a role in different areas than the one it did during the post-war boom, and particularly, and most obviously, the shift for state funding, which hasn't fallen, by the way. In fact, state spending keeps on growing, but it's what's being spent on, which is military, surveillance, and not on giving money to unemployed people, or in the case of Britain, the National Health Service, which more or less just about functions. But, you know, is under severe pressure there. So, come back to the original point about periodization. Capitalism isn't a game that's going to go on forever. I mean, the environmental crisis is a threat to the entire planet, and indeed to the system as well. But the system ages, economically ages. There are a limited number of options as to what can actually happen. You know, how you can run a capitalist economy. It's not an infinite number of different variations. So I don't think we're going to see anything that's going to be completely new or things we haven't seen before. What we're seeing is dipping back into the old playbook from 30, 40, 50 years ago and bringing forward solutions, which, let's bring ourselves, led to war in the end, and now bringing these things back now because they don't know what else to do. I think we have to get out of our heads the idea that the ruling class have a cunning plan, you know, which they really, you know, whatever they do is really in their interest and so on. They don't, to a large extent. I think they're floundering, and the options that they have left for them are not pleasant ones. I mean, Joel Greer was talking in the previous session about the potential for war between China and America, and I don't think that's an immediate prospect, but that's, you know, as the economic crisis deepens and there appears to be no way out of it, that is a solution that will actually emerge for ruling classes of the world, and not least this one, as a way of their problem. So, on that cheerful note, I think we have to conclude by saying that the urgency of what we need to do, we have to, without panicking, you know, and hysterical kind of responses, I think that's terribly disabling, but soberly look at it and say, look, that is really serious. I don't want to proclaim the end of the system, and it won't collapse of its own accord. I think Rosa Luxemburg and everybody else who suggested that were wrong, and it wouldn't be in the interest of the working class anyway if the system just collapsed in that kind of way. Imagine what that would be like. But it's the danger of it, we know what's happened in the past, it won't be a repetition of that, because history does not repeat itself in the same kind of way, ever. But the dangers of war and the emerging out of crisis, I think, are very real and should give us some urgency when we think about our enemy, whether it is neoliberalism or something else. It's still capitalism, and that basis has to be fought. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.